Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
A science story, huh?
Is NYU scientist the...
I felt right.
I was so
and I just thought, well...
I had figured it out.
It was that golden moment.
Because science was on my side.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Story Collider, where we present true personal stories about science. I am your host, Liz Neely, and I'm running solo this week without the calming presence of our one and only Aaron Barker, so please brace yourselves. And of course, this would be the week that we're presenting stories about the very particular struggles we face when we try to figure out or fix something all alone. Welcome to our episode on asking for help. Aaron and I had been joking last week that we'd been eerily ahead of the curve in planning our upcoming episodes, and yep, here we are again. Hopefully, Aaron is on the mend and will be back soon. She just needed a break from recording, and that's what I'm here for. And fortunately, after being co-directors of the Story Collider for 5 years, we have much better communication skills and are better at asking each other for help. In fact, Aaron is so good at figuring out when I need help that she will occasionally override my stubborn insistence that I am absolutely fine. And this is how I once ended up with an entire pallet of Doritos from her during a particularly stressful period. No, this is not sponsored content. Yes, Doritos are my comfort food. No, I'm not proud of that. But this is what I love about help, right? You never know what form it might take and how much you need it and how much you needed it right then. Thinking about it, it actually makes me feel better when I start worrying about how I'm going to take care of everyone, when it feels like everything is just falling apart. And kind of, I think this is like what mutual aid is all about. Maybe we help each other with donations. Maybe we help each other with something like sharing some spare flour or toilet paper. I know for me, it's already been taking the form of things like sharing Girl Scout cookies with friends who couldn't get any groceries or getting delivery takeout from an amazing Laotian restaurant. Help can look like a goofy team happy hour on Zoom, or just a text that says, "Hey, I'm thinking about you. How are you holding up?" And I mean, look at me. Here I am. I've come back around to talking about giving help instead of asking for it, because asking for help is still so, so hard. Our storytellers today have a lot to say about that, so let's get to it. Our first story is from Aparna Agarwal. It was recorded in June 2019 at the Evolution Meetings in Providence, Rhode Island. This was a show sponsored by the diversity committees of the American Society of Naturalists, Society of Systematic Biologists, and Society for the Study of Evolution. The theme that night was Outside the Distribution.
So I joined graduate school when I was 20 years old, right after my undergraduate degree, and I was completely clueless about what I wanted to do with my life. I mean, really, really clueless. I applied to management programs and a job at the bank and a PhD program just for the fun of it. I essentially did anything that at that time anybody told me was the thing to do. And then I ended up joining the PhD program because I just had so much fun at the interviews. And I know that interviews are not generally supposed to be fun, but I was so convinced that I am not going to get in that I just rambled my mind off. And for the first time in my life, you know, explaining every single detail of every single assumption that I had made was something that people appreciated. And though they let me in, which I was convinced was a mistake, but I was not going to let them know that. And so I joined the graduate program, and then really weird things started to happen. You know, I would always crack jokes, and then, for the first time in my life, people actually laughed. Because, you see, I come from a family which is very, very supportive, but they don't know science. So anytime I started telling them a joke, I then had to tell them all about the background science, to which my very supportive parents would fall asleep listening to. So here, for the first time, people laughed, or quite often they groaned, but the point was they understood what I was saying. And so I was having the time of my life. But at the same time, I felt incredibly lonely, because I had always taught myself about science from books, from the internet, and I knew that in my family, when I was telling them those stories, or when I was telling them about the science, they weren't going to fact check me. But here, everybody was so amazing and brilliant and knew their science, and if I made a mistake now, they're going to know. And they're also going to know that, you know, it was a mistake putting me into this program, and they're going to kick me out. So I decided that I'm not going to let that happen. And the best way to do that is to make sure that I don't make any mistake, and I never ever ask for help, because if I do, then they'll know. So this is me in my lab. It's barren because A, it's a new lab and there aren't that many instruments. And B, it's 6:30 a.m. because I'm just that kind of a person. I go all out. And and I'm determined to make a really, really good impression. And so I've decided to do an experiment on my own, which I've never done before, but I know that it comes with a list of instructions, and I know that I can follow that. So even though I've never seen fancy equipment like pipettes before in my life, I have decided that I'm going to do this experiment entirely on my own, and I'm going to make the best, most fantastic first impression ever made. So I go in, I collect everything that I need, and then I see that on the shelf is a box of gloves that is labeled small. Now, this is a problem because my hands aren't small. In fact, growing up, little boys used to always compare their hand sizes to my hand size to see if it was big enough. And once I went on a date, and this guy actually held my hand very romantically, only to look down and say, "Oh." So this is a problem, but I'm not going to let this come in my way. I am going to do this experiment. And I decided that the best thing to do is to put on those small gloves and continue with the experiment anyway. Here's the thing, though. When you put on a small glove on a large hand like mine, the degree of movement that you have between your thumb and your finger, not much. This is what I realized as 5 seconds later, I only have the cap of the bottle that I'm holding in my hand, and the bottle itself is on the floor. Okay. Good. This happened. I can book my flight tickets back. I should call up the management people and see if they will take a person 6 months late. And I've made friends. I'm sure I can keep in touch with them over email. They'll remember me. They like my jokes. And this is it. It's good that it happened so early on, because clearly I'm not meant to do science. I can't even open a bottle safely. So I clean the spill up. Then I rush to my computer to see how much the chemical costed. I realize that there's a roadshow going on, so I run up to the executive and explain to him that I need this chemical right now. And then he tells me that he's going to try and bring it to me as soon as he can. And then I realized that I have to now go and tell my advisor this. I am scared. I am really scared at this point. I know that I'm going to get the shouting of my life. She's going to tell me to leave. And I'm just bracing myself as I climb up the stairs to her cabin. And I knock on her door and she says, come in. And I go in and I just blurt everything out. To which she replies, Aparna, I have no idea what you just said. Calm down, take a deep breath and tell me again. Okay. So I repeat my story, this time a little bit slowly. And at the point when I tell her that I put on the wrong size gloves, she just looks at me and says, wait, why didn't you just buy a box for yourself? And I'm like, what? Like, that's a possibility? I'm allowed to do things for convenience? See, I'm so used to at this point for always fighting for things, for always, like, you know, learning things on my own without asking for help, that I didn't even realize that this was a possibility. And then she walks down with me and we go back to the bench. She stays with me for the rest of the experiment. She puts on the gloves because it's right for her hand. And then she does something. She goes to the next lab and she asks for a bunch of gloves for me. And because she herself was a new PI, she didn't really know what was where. So she then went ahead and asked graduate students in the other lab for help. And again, I'm like, what? Because I know that she is brilliant. I've spoken to her, I've seen her give talks, and there's no doubt in my mind that she is brilliant at her science, and she is asking help from a graduate student. And then she stayed with me for the rest of the experiment, explaining to me tiny details, teaching me how to do things, and just telling me, it's fine, don't worry about the chemical, it's not expensive, and we have a lot of it in the bag. Just make sure you don't do this again. And something in the middle of all of this just clicks. Not dramatically. It's not that I never made a mistake again, and it's not that I never ever had anxiety again. I did. I had a whole bunch of mistakes. I was in a new lab. I was standardizing things. I made mistakes almost daily. But I finished my graduate program. I am towards the end of my PhD. And the one thing I was convinced of during the course of it all was that I, as an individual, am allowed my own box of gloves.
That was Aparna Agarwal. Aparna is a graduate student in Dr. Deepa Agashe's lab at the National Center for Biological Sciences in Bangalore, India. She's doing that by day. The rest of the time, she claims that she's a random thoughts compiler whenever inspiration strikes. Currently, she's working to understand the adaptation and role of microbes in the process of adaptation using the red flower beetle. She loves to travel in person, as well as through the magic of books, articles, blogs, conversation, and just stories in general. She enjoys using these stories to help her share and build her science. Aparna was such a delight. We laughed so hard while we were preparing that story. And that show all together was just one of my favorites. I will never forget that during the show, my co-host and I, Katie Wu, almost caused a riot by sharing our unpopular science opinions, including just the innocuous, or so we thought, statement, I actually like powdered gloves, which if you haven't spent a lot of time in the lab or in a medical setting, it used to be the case that the gloves that we wear sometimes came with a cornstarch powder coating. The idea was to make them easier to take on and off. The problem is that coating If you wear those gloves for a long time, can get sticky, can irritate your hands. Also, turns out there were concerns about latex allergies with the particles being, you know, sort of floating through the air, as well as some medical concerns about patient wound healing and things like that. So turns out 2017 FDA banned all powdered gloves. So there, you learned something about science. And sort of to balance that out, I want to make sure that I recommend a couple of stories to you. So last week, Erin said she finds a lot of comfort and solace in listening to funny stories. And in fact, that is exactly what we did in our first ever live streamed virtual show. We were going to be hosting these every Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and you can join us for this next one. To sort of counteract that, to balance that, I also like sometimes listening to very serious stories about how people have coped. And fortunately, the Story Collider has two episodes in our back catalog about epidemics. Our first one is from Jo Handelsman. Her story is about her very first day working as a science advisor in the Obama White House. And she finds herself right in the middle of the emerging Ebola crisis. We also have journalist Erica Check Hayden telling her own Ebola story about being a young mother heading to Sierra Leone to report on the crisis unfolding there. It's a story about the ties in a family and community and how we cope with the strain that these disasters place on us. These stories about trying to cope when we are in over our head makes me think of the next story, actually.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Our second story today is from Jesse Hildebrand. It was recorded in October 2019 at Burdock Music Hall in Toronto, Ontario. The theme of that show was Lesson Learned.
I've booked a manta ray tour in Kona on the west side of Hawaii's beautiful Big Island, and I am breathlessly excited. When I booked the tour, there were two options. For $100, you go out for a night dive where they shine lights in the water and attract the plankton, which bring in the mantis. Or for $125, only $25 extra, you do that same dive and another one earlier in the afternoon where you get a chance to see in the light some of the other amazing creatures off the coast. Well, frugal guy that I am, $25 extra for almost an extra hour in the water, sign me up. I'm standing in the lobby of the dive shop, and it's an exercise in absolute patience. I cannot wait to be in the water. Afraid of scaring off the other 15 or so tourists with my sheer rampant ridiculous enthusiasm, I idly finger the goggles and dive paraphernalia and hope not to be noticed. And I'm a little intimidated, frankly. The professionalism of the place, the clear signs that all the other tourists there have lived a life in and on the water. The selection and cost of all the dive gear are astonishing. And these pictures of dive trips to Indonesia, other remote places all around the world, are leaving me a little bit out of my depth as a rookie, shall we say. And so, finally, the van arrives to pick us up and takes us to our dive site. And I'm going to get a chance to see these mantas. And so I grew up in love with animals. Crocodile Hunter was my hero. Then David Attenborough was my hero. They still are. And whenever I travel in pursuit of wildlife and wild places. But I'd never pursued anything beneath the waves before. And this would be my first. Most of my favorite animals are apex predators, things with lots of teeth. Sharks, crocodiles, lions and tigers and bears, oh my. And mantas are the only exception to that. They are, simply put, magical. They can be over 20 feet, bigger than this room, wingtip to wingtip. They're black or deep blue with white lines in them. They look like nothing else. They move like nothing else. They're the most graceful and elegant creatures in the ocean. They're the gentle giants of the sea. And I cannot wait to finally see one. Our guide is a baked to the bone tanned guy with long flowing blonde hair like Fabio, who has the mannerisms of Jack Sparrow, peak rum in Pirates of the Caribbean, whose first line to me, I kid you not, is, "Hey bro, the name's Flipper." Now, you'd think this would be disconcerting, but no. Any man who is so sure of himself as to choose a name that I liken to a movie dolphin, I figure is going to be perfectly adept in the water. I'm very confident in Flipper. And so our van gets to the boat. We take the boat out to the dive site, and the deckhand jumps off the deck and ties up our boat to a buoy under the waves. The scuba half of our contingent gets into the water, and they head out. And now it's our turn as the snorkel team to get ready. And so first we have to put on our wetsuits, and everyone else slips into theirs like a second skin. And I struggle mightily with mine. It doesn't fit, it's tight, it chafes, it's hot. I barely get it on. There's a zipper that's sort of at the back that I manage, after much struggle, to get up. And it's at this point that Flipper looks to the group and asks, "Has everyone used a snorkel before?" Now, I have never used a snorkel before. In fact, up until the dive shop this morning, I've never even seen a snorkel in real life. My only ocean experience is splashing in the light surf and making a sandcastle on the beach the day before. And yet, even though we're about to embark on a 45-minute swim in choppy seas with a wetsuit for the first time and fins for the first time, I say yes. Because I don't want to seem like an idiot in front of these other, obviously adept tourists. And besides, it's a piece of plastic tubing. One end goes in your mouth, one end goes above the water. How hard could it possibly be? And so we jump in the water, and pretty much instantly, with my snorkel not in properly, I begin to inhale a little bit of salt water. I'm also unduly alarmed at the fact that my wetsuit is filling with water, which, fortunately, once it stops, I realize that's probably okay. But the fins, which are supposed to propel us so nicely through the waves, for me are an impediment. I keep kicking myself in the legs with my fins, and while everyone else paddles away like a fish, I cycle like mad just to keep at the end of the pack of tourists that are following Flipper. And so after about 50 feet of swimming, Flipper looks back to the group and says, "Is everyone all right?" Now, rather than say, "Help me, I'm slowly drowning and I've inhaled some salt water and I can't swim, please," I flash a stupid grin. I give a hearty thumbs up as my legs beat furiously under the water, and I say yes. And so Flipper goes, "Great!" And he turns around, and the grin is instantly removed from my face as a little wave hits me, and I inhale a little bit more salt water. And so over the next 40 minutes, I come to realize that swimming, previously second nature to me, is incredibly difficult when you're choking and inhaling salt water. Little waves come in the top of my snorkel, and I can't clear them. My mask fills with water, and the only way I know how to get rid of it is to take the mask off, and so more water gets in. I am flailing here. This is really quite pathetic. And so I see ahead of me, as again, I'm beating furiously, that people are pointing at various amazing creatures in the water. And I don't see any of them. I see blobs and dark shapes because my mask is full and I'm choking and it's horrible. And so we've circled the boat, and I'm just about at the stage where I'm willing to ask for help. And I realize, oh, we circled back, we're about to get back on the boat in a minute. And it's then that I throw up in my mouth, which incidentally makes the snorkel even harder to use. And so I take off my mask and snorkel, kind of panicking at this point, and seriously consider just chucking it to the depths. It's not helping me at all. But I realize that won't be received very well, so I sort of half-heartedly put it back on, and I throw up a little more in the water. And I begin to panic a little bit. This isn't good. But with my last bit of muscular effort, I make it to the boat, and I climb the ladder, and I get on, and I have never gotten out of a piece of clothing faster than I got out of that wetsuit. And I run to the only bathroom on the boat. And so I'd heard what happens when you inhale a lot of salt water or drink it, but I never experienced it firsthand. My body goes through a complete and total nuclear meltdown. As far as it's concerned, I've been heavily poisoned, and it does everything, and I mean everything, in its power to get rid of that poison. The bathroom doesn't help matters any. It's about 6 feet long, 5 feet tall so you can't stand up properly, and 2.5 feet wide. So when you're sitting on the toilet, your knees are touching both walls. It's painted jet black, don't know why. And there's this little horror movie light above the sink that actually puts my sickness in stark relief. It's quite awful. And so I'm there wishing for death, being sicker than I've ever been in my life, and thinking that death might actually be granted. And I realize after a bit of this that the toilet also will be a cause of my problems because it doesn't flush. But instead is operated with a little hand pump on the ground that makes water come through a little hose so you can clean up everything you've created nice and close. At this point, I'm mortifyingly aware, having been in here for what feels like eons, but it's probably about half an hour, that this is the only bathroom on the boat and other people might need to use it. And so feeling sorry for them and wanting to welcome them into the hellhole of my own creation, I come out and I take 2 steps out of the bathroom and I go right back in. And I'm astonishingly equally sick the second round. And so finally, probably a full hour of this, I come out, I'm Kermit green in hue, I look awful, and I plop down on the bench. And it's at that point that the second night dive's supposed to begin. There's no way I can go. But Flipper says, you came all this way. Just try, man, see what happens. It's gonna be okay. I put 1 foot in the wetsuit, nausea instantly back. I say, there's no way. Reluctantly, he and the other tourists get into the water and they start heading out to the dive site. And I ask the captain where I can best sit to feel better. He says, the bow. So I curl up in the fetal position on the front of the boat, in extremis, just still nauseous, sad, dejected, and profoundly disappointed that if I'd had just a little less pride and asked for help with the snorkel at the beginning, I'd be with the other people in the water, having come thousands of miles for this and seeing this incredible creature. And instead, as far as I can tell, there's 4 other tour boats in the area. I'm the only boat-bound tourist of the lot. And so as I see their lights dancing under the water for about 40 minutes, I pettily hope that they see absolutely nothing. Because then at least my immense stupidity will not have been, you know, cost me anything. But no, when they get back on the boat, they show stories and show pictures and saw many mantas. And it was pretty much universally decided it was the greatest experience of everybody's life. Curse them all. And so, sulking and still dejected, we make the boat ride back to shore and the van ride back to the dive shop. And tail between my legs, I make the 1 kilometer walk of shame, still sick, back to my hotel room, where I curl up for one of the most necessary sleeps of my entire life. This year, I got my scuba license. Pretty much solely so I can go back one day triumphantly with the magical ability to now breathe underwater and see the mantas that I missed with the snorkel fiasco. Although now, with professional training, I can use a snorkel like nobody's business. And until I get that triumphant return, in the meantime, whenever a tour guide or family or friend asks if I can do some potentially dangerous task, I plead absolute ignorance and humbly beg to be told to do whatever simple-minded thing it is. Thank you guys so much.
That was Jesse Hildebrand. Jesse is the founder of Science Literacy Week, a Canada-wide celebration of science that grew from 4 events in 2014 to over 800 events in 100 cities coast to coast in 2017. Jesse claims that he suffers from an excess of personality. I think it's just about right. He says he watches too many Blue Jay games for his own good and can enter into a spirited debate on the merits of the Marvel films. Jesse was our Toronto-based producer. We miss him very much and wish him very well. We are so grateful to Aparna and to Jesse for sharing their stories with us. The Story Collider is also intensely grateful for the support of Science Sandbox, a Simons Foundation initiative dedicated to engaging everyone with the process of science. The Story Collider is led by our artistic director, the one, the only, Aaron Barker, and me, executive director, Liz Neely. We couldn't do it without the help of our deputy director, Nissa Greenberg, our operations manager, Lindsay Cooper, and the rest of our amazing team. The stories featured in today's podcast were from shows produced by Misha Gajewski and Jesse Hildebrand, as well as by Zach Stovall and Catherine Wu. The podcast is edited by our podcast team, including Jun Chen and Gwen Hogan. The theme music is by Ghost. Special thanks to the Joint Diversity Committees of the Evolution Meetings and to Burdock Brewery for hosting these shows. And thanks to everyone out there who's brave enough to ask for help and everyone else who's kind enough to give it. Thank you for listening and take care.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.